This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this show on Free Speech TV nationwide and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates. We take for granted the internet today and all its myriad social networking tools. We use them to debate and discuss, organize and mobilize. But only a few decades ago, these tools were not available to political activists seeking to challenge authority. From the Zapatista movement in Mexico to the anti-World Trade Organization protests in Seattle to Occupy Wall Street, the Arab Spring, Black Lives Matter, Standing Rock, and the Women's March, social movements today have taken full advantage of digital technologies to mobilize large numbers of people. But we are still evolving these tools and assessing their strengths and weaknesses. There is both power and fragility in organizing in this manner. Joining me to discuss this is Zeynep Tufekci. She is a contributing opinion writer for the New York Times, associate professor at the University of North Carolina's School of Information and Library Science, and a faculty associate at the Harvard Berkman Center for Internet and Society. She joins me to discuss her new book, Twitter and Tear Gas, The Power and Fragility of Networked Protest. Welcome to the program, Zeynep.
Thank you for inviting me.
Thanks so much for joining us. So I remember when the Seattle, they were called an anti-globalization protest against the World Trade Organization took place. It was 1999. A few years earlier, the Zapatistas had burst into the scene. And back then, people had cell phones, but they didn't have social media. Were those some of the earliest examples of using the internet to mobilize and organize quite successfully?
Right, exactly. The moment you have cell phones, it completely changes the game even without social media. And I mean, since we're kind of the same cohort and we both remember the same era, with the Zapatista movement, it allowed this what is basically an indigenous peasant uprising of the kind that occurs fairly regularly in Central and South America to have solidarity from abroad. That was quite impressive because they were able to communicate. They had these communiques and they would bring them down to the nearby town because in the mountains they didn't even have electricity. So they would write them out and then from there it would go out on the internet and then the solidarity movement that had sprung up globally would mobilize to try to help them and try to pressure the Mexican government. So even that little level of connectivity made a big difference in breaking the isolation that these kinds of movements face. And if you sort of go forward to the Seattle anti-corporate globalization movement, it was one of the first, I think, it wasn't just, obviously, there was a lot of traditional like unions that organized, there were a lot of existing formal organizations that were part of that. But what happened there was, I think it was the first time as far as I know, I'm just trying to think, is there anything comparable? I can't even think of anything. It was the first time that a large number of people, first they organized a lot of people besides those people in formal organizations using just email. I had been following this and I had, knew of it and, tried to and arrange to go to that, not because I was part of any traditional movement, an organization. I had just, as a person, which was kind of new. But more importantly, people were also able to gather in very large numbers to the surprise of the World Trade Organization and control the streets with pretty impressive, effective direct action, which is making a statement that as long as these big institutions remain non-transparent, we're going to challenge them. And I remember reading later the police, they were dumbfounded by the fact that they would use all their traditional techniques because police have always had radios, right? They could always communicate. And for the first time, they had encountered protesters that were as effective, as agile, as sort of organizing in the moment because the protesters could also communicate. So it was really a turning point. Of course, back then we didn't have social media. We didn't have all the things we could do. You couldn't just take out your phone and live stream. But you had all the little things. You had in the media, you had, a bunch of things that would later turn into the full-scale version that we've started seeing After we saw it in the Arab uprisings, we saw it in Occupy, we saw it in lots of movements, Turkey's Gezi Park protests, Hong Kong's Occupy Central. So that's sort of the era. And the question that motivated me is, I mean, obviously, if you, like me, are of this cohort that sort of saw this happen, it's pretty clear that it changed the way we do things in social movements. It drastically changed them. But on the other hand, sort of, you sort of look at it, you kind of step back and look at it, authoritarianism is around the world on the rise, right? There's a lot of unsettling things going on, and the empowerment isn't just a straightforward story in which you can just say, oh, look, we can live stream, we can communicate, we can go on Twitter and raise a lot of attention. All of those things are true, but there's some really subtle and complex, it's just we're doing things differently. It's reconfiguration. And I wanted to sort of think through what is this reconfiguration? And I wanted to do this without being a curmudgeon, because you don't want to say, oh, don't use them, do it the whole way, because that makes no sense, right? These tools have real power. And they have empowered movements. But doing things differently is not a straightforward good or bad, right? It's just different. That's what I'm struggling with, and that's why I wrote the book.
And so, here in the US, the history that we often look to is of a very successful movement is a civil rights movement that mobilized large numbers of people, but even small numbers of people to do very effective things, all before you couldn't do much more than leafletting or just organizing at meetings. You had to physically be present. And you talk in your book about how it used to be that a massive march was the culmination of many, many months of work. And of course, even today, it can still take months to organize a march, like for example, the Women's March. But often, you have the mobilizing happening as the first step in a major movement rather than a mid-step. What does that do to movements?
I mean, if you look at, I gave the civil rights movement example, and I want to emphasize, I mean, it's not some ideal, frozen, nostalgic thing. It was a very complex, long struggle. But they had to organize for maybe a decade before they could even get to the point where they could consider managing the logistics of something like the March on Washington and managing the whole everything that goes with it. Whereas if you look at, say, Occupy or you look at Women's March, it goes from like somebody's Facebook post or the March for Science. Somebody has an idea, and 2 months later, boom, there are a million people in the street. So on the one hand, the ability to mobilize such large numbers is pretty significant, right? Marches do lots of things. You meet people, you get energized, you make a statement. So there's power in that kind of protest. On the other hand, the best way to understand the potency of a social movement action is try to say, if I were in power, what does this mean to me? Right? So if you're in power and you see a march that's taken 2 months to organize, what you're seeing, you're not necessarily seeing the same kind of power and same kind of threat that a movement that takes 10 years to organize. What I sort of sometimes compare this to, say, like exercising or climbing a mountain or something like that. For example, one of my metaphors is climbing Mount Everest, right? When you're climbing Mount Everest, it's on people's sort of list of things to do. So there's now an industry that helps people. And there are Sherpas who are local indigenous people who are really hardy and know how to mountaineer. They're carrying all these Westerners who paid for this. They're carrying their bags and they're carrying their equipment and they're carrying all of that. Now, you can get to the top of that mountain if somebody else carries your stuff for you. That's what kind of the internet does for us. It carries our stuff for us. So without having that 10 years of organizing that the civil rights movement had to do, or without having the all the sort of work you have to do to be a real mountaineer that can carry their own stuff, you can do things. But it doesn't give you the kind of skills you need to do the next thing. Right? So if everything goes wrong and the weather is gorgeous and somebody carries your stuff and they carry oxygen, so you don't even have to worry about the thin air, you can summit Mount Everest. But you probably couldn't even do a much, much smaller mountain on your own because you don't have that capacity. Somebody helped you along.
Right, it
So,
hasn't been built up over many years.
with the internet, it gives you like really, it carries your stuff, which is great because you want some of your stuff to be carried and that gives you a lot of power. But the issue there is it doesn't give you, for example, the capacity to do tactical shifts, right? Because you need collective decision making for a movement to succeed. Like after you do a march, what's next,
Right.
right? How are you going to make a decision? All those things require many years of working together before you have that. So you see this right now in the United States. We had the Women's March. It was large. It was great. I marched. It was sort of very empowering for lots of people. And then everybody keeps marching. You have a march after march, and it's kind of losing its potency, and it's not really threatening the people in power much because it's just the marches are getting smaller because the movement sprung up very quickly in the US after an election that surprised lots of people, but it doesn't have the capacity to try to decide what's next, how do we, take the next turn, and all of those things that you need for movements to do. So instead of being like a culmination, as you said, of 10 years of movement building, the march is the first step. And the mistake a lot of people make is to say, oh, look, it's a big march. And you kind of compare it to the past and you say, in the past, big marches meant something. Therefore, big marches must mean something now. And I say, in the past, the big marches meant something that was 10 years of work and then you could do it. Whereas right now, you start organizing after the big march. The big march itself is just like the first step. And the digital media is like, that's like reconfiguration. Things don't really mean the same thing. And that kind of logistic ability to hold huge things, you can use Google spreadsheets, you can use Twitter hashtags, you can get the word out, you can get around censorship. Those are empowering. But scaling up that fast, you got wobbly legs. You're just sort of, it's like you got a car, it's going really fast. Because you got these tools that leave the car, going very fast, but you haven't really built your steering wheel, and you need to steer, right? And that's what a lot of movements that I've studied have hit a wall.
So
They like got,
let's examine some examples. Here in the US, we had Occupy Wall Street. We have a benefit of a little bit of hindsight. We saw, of course, the Arab Spring marches, particularly Egypt is a really good example. I'll let you pick which one you want to sort of share an example with, but were both of those movements one that showed that while you could have a wide, a huge mobilizing, the movement sadly wasn't deep enough to sustain the next step.
So I want to say, with Egypt, maybe they never had a chance, right? There's an
Right.
enormous amount of repetition. Who knows? It's kind of hard to do this, but obviously, yes, it had scaled up very quickly. So let's talk about the U.S. one because we're here and it's a more familiar example. The people who wrote to Occupy, the initial email that sparked it, a comment really sprung with me, stuck with me. I'm sorry. And the comment that they when they wrote the email, they said, "Look, you know what? In this age, you can go for just one email to really rewarding stuff like the occupying the Zuccotti Park, having it go all over the U.S., having global marches in a couple of months. It's really rewarding, and it's you just do this very fast, and you get payoff really quickly. But the problem is, when you do it like that, very fast, and you haven't really resolved a lot of major issues, like how do you make decisions? Occupy tried to keep doing assemblies." Those were, they look democratic, but if you examine them, they're really anti-democratic. It's just the people who show up, people who don't have jobs. It's a very bad way to try to make collective decisions if you want to be participatory, to be honest. And if some aggressive people take over it and then they shut down. And so, despite the fact that Occupy had this very legitimate, topic, inequality. It's a burning question of our times. It's at the heart of many of the imbalances in the world. It had great popular support. It captured hearts and minds, to use a cliche, very quickly. But when it was evicted from Zuccotti Park and a few places, it just got stuck. I call this tactical freeze. If you don't have a sensible way of making decisions and participatory way, and if you don't have 10 years of working together with people or 5 years, some amount, it's very hard to figure out what's next. So Occupy kind of got stuck. And also, it never figured out how to engage things besides occupations. How do you engage the electoral sphere, right? If you want to, you know, push the Democrats, how do you push the Democrats? How do you get more of your agenda adopted? How do you push policy changes? What else can you do? I mean, there's a whole range of things. I don't mean to say elections are everything, but there's a whole range of things movements do. And Occupy did one thing, and it was kind of this big spectacular thing. And as soon as it reached an end, and everything you do eventually reaches an end, it just was tactically frozen and it couldn't do anything else. Now compare that, you know, it's not just the digital tool, it's the political culture too. The strategic thinking is much deeper on the right side of the political spectrum, like the Tea Party movement. Obviously the left and the right don't have the same movements because on the left, participation is more valued. You know, you want to have a voice. It's not going to be as hierarchical. But the strategic thinking part on the right is much deeper. And I think people will be surprised by this, but it's, I believe it's true. Even local organizing is much, much stronger in this country on the right. The left organizes fairly little, and it's just been started to do that since the election. The left uses the digital technology to push its narrative very effectively, but doesn't do the organizing. And by organizing, I don't mean don't use digital technology. I mean organize and mobilize people using digital technologies and other kinds of tools. So it's not a tool thing. It's kind of like how do you use the tools? So you look at the Tea Party movement. It starts, again, online. You know, it starts after something happens on CNBC, a rant on taxes and all of that. And after they held a national march on 2009, similar to Occupy. You know, it's just 2 years before that. They had a protest march, and they used their protest march to launch, right? They treated their protest march as the first step. And when the protest march kind of, you know, it's a thing you can do once or twice, and then the eighth time isn't really useful, they started going into these local organization, and they had the strategy of primary challenges and, you know, complex strategic.
So they were able to translate their issues into policy.
Right. Now, the other thing, of course, that's different is on the right, they got massive cash infusion very quickly.
Yeah, of course.
And on the left right now, after all this brouhaha, I talked to, say, the Indivisibles, which is doing really strategic thinking. It's doing, you know, more, it's kind of visible. It's one of those movement things that sprung up after the election. It's visible. I want to give you two numbers to give you the imbalance. In 2016, last year, the Koch brothers, the rich, wealthy brothers who helped fund Tea Party, funded down-ballot races, which are crucial because that's how you organize. Presidential races are how you get results from your organizing. They're not how you organize. So the down-ballot races, they funded them to the tune of $1 billion. That is billion with a B, just one family. Whereas the Indivisible group, which has gotten so much attention, I talked to them a couple of weeks ago, and after all this brouhaha, they had raised only $2.2 million with an M, and most of it was from grassroots.
Wow.
So on the right, you have these huge billionaires that are willing to write large checks, whereas on the, like the Silicon Valley, sitting on its hands or meeting with Trump, the progressive liberal, sort of the rich people who sort of proclaim themselves to be liberal or progressive are all sitting on their hands, basically, whereas the right-wing billionaires are writing very large checks. So that also affects, you know, what you can do. I mean, the grassroots fundraising is obviously possible, and a lot of people are doing it, and you saw with Bernie's campaign how big it could get. But it's still hard to match because Trump, too, people don't notice this, he raised a lot of money from small donors, right? So he has a base that also uses these tools. So it's kind of this interesting moment in which Trump is not very popular, was not, at least before the election, with the GOP elite. And they weren't really funding him. And there was, he has a base that kind of raised money for him, using Facebook especially. Facebook was really helpful to Trump's fundraising operation. And whereas on the left, you have the same kind of situation where, but although the right has Koch brothers, Mercers, other people that fund infrastructure. So that's kind of like, this is the US context, and this part is more recent. But when I look at this, what I see is the left has gotten really good at using digital technologies for things it's good at, but still has not figured out how it complicates. Like getting very big very quickly is a dangerous thing. You're very exposed when you're not ready to be such a, you get very big and you got your under pressure. So that's kind of what I see in the U.S. right now, is that it's a vulnerable moment because, say, the midterms are just almost a year away.
So, Zainab, let me ask you this then. From having written this book and the research that you did to put it together, and also looking at global counterparts to U.S. movements, how can people mobilize for the digital age? Not to sort of ask you for a nutshell prescription, but if there are some things that you've gleaned that people could, guidelines that they could use when they do their organizing, as your heart sits left, it seems, what advice would you give left movements, people say involved in the Women's March or Indivisible?
So I would say, like, for movements for positive social change, let's say it this way, right? What you need is to find people you can work with, and to work with those people over longer periods of time. It's kind of tedious, right? Building trust among each other, figuring out how to do things. And what I see on the left side of the political spectrum is that every 4 years they get excited or not about a presidential candidate. But the down ballot is how you organize your infrastructure. And it requires working, you know, at the state level, at the county level, at whatever else level. And in the left, in the past, you had unions and other institutions that were kind of there. Whereas on the right, you have some churches and NRA and other things that kind of do that kind of organization. But on the left, we have lost, and it's not just the left, I would say also sort of even the liberal part of the spectrum, the kind of fabric of what keeps civic society together and democracy together has been greatly weakened. We don't have institutions. Like, if you want to meet with people on a political thing, where do you go, right? There's no, you know, union hall. There's no people sort of teaching you how to run for office. There's very little infrastructure. It's been a 20-year decline. Some of it exists in big cities, but the big cities need it least. You need to organize more. I mean, you need the big cities too. I don't get me wrong. I have no, like, I think the big cities are really important, but you need to sort of do that and do that behind. Even there, like, if you look at the blue states, a lot of them have Republican senators. They have Republican governors. And it's not because the states are purple. It's because the Democrats don't organize properly. I have to say, I mean, you look at the sort of the voting patterns, you have a lot of races where nobody's running, right? And you look at sort of the presidential rate, it's a blue county, but you look at down ballot, it's all red. Why is it all red? Maybe some of those people would have won anyway. And I'm not saying they should never, you know, that people should never sort of, we should win every election, but there's so many elections that are not even contested.
Right.
There's so many social, and I want to be clear, it sounds like I'm talking about elections, but it's a good example. There's such a wide range of social movement tactics.
Right.
If you think about, since the election, I mean, my Facebook feed is full of like 17 more marches being organized. And I've marched my whole life. I mean, I have nothing against marches, but when you look at it tactically, and you're like, why is there 17 more marches being organized? It's partly because strategic thinking and strategic depth takes time to develop. And the left side of the spectrum has just not done that. And so we're just repeating ourselves because we don't know what to do.
Well, Zainab, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. Perhaps people will pick up copies of your book to learn some of these lessons.
Thank you.
My guest is Zeynep Tüfekçi, contributing opinion writer for the New York Times, associate professor at University of North Carolina's School of Information and Library Science, and a faculty associate at the Harvard Berkman Center for Internet and Society. We're talking about her new book, Twitter and Tear Gas, The Power and Fragility of Network Protests. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also find us on Facebook, Twitter, iTunes, and Vimeo.